those who let the hand of Islam go. We've seen their fate. I don't want no parts of that.
Right. When you get on to tell a story, I'm gonna tell a story. I went to a gymnasium today, right? I think I'm gonna wait till it gets on the air, and I'm gonna tell about the story on the gymnasium.
We're gonna
get into some stuff, man. Because you know I admire you, I like your writings, and we're gonna get into some real good stuff.
I look forward to it, Brother
Tim. The music's coming on, so I'm gonna shut up until my turn comes.
Yes, sir. As will I.
This is in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in the United States. We stand with you.
All praise be to God.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
We're poor. Ashe.
Ashe.
We're poor to the creative spirit. The great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. nation, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who raised the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open-air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God," or "Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions, the children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents, those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Dr.
John Henry Clark, John
Dr. Khaled
Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Good evening, good afternoon to all of you, my sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. We thank you so much for joining us today. We're off to just a little bit of a late start, but we're excited anyway. We have a magnificent and marvelous guest, a very dear brother, who we had an opportunity to have on our program maybe about a year ago. Nevertheless, he has agreed to come back with us again today. We were supposed to have him on a couple of weeks ago, but things changed, and that's a very busy schedule that my brother is on, so which makes it even more honored to have him here today, is that he took time from that busy schedule to come and be with us here at the Black Reality Think Tank family. So we thank him so much. We're not going to prolong anything. We know that our normal routine is to do our ancestral profile and so forth. But I want to get right on into our discussion with my dear brother because, again, as I said, he's on a very busy schedule, and I know that he's moving and doing a lot, but he has definitely agreed to be with us. So good afternoon, Dr. Wesley. How are you?
I am excellent. How about yourself?
Wonderful. Doing great. And thank you so much for coming on. I know we had touched bases earlier this afternoon, but I'm so happy that you were able to make it and that you are here.
Oh, it's my tremendous honor. My apologies for having to reschedule, but I'm glad we were able to synchronize our schedules and have this conversation that I'm very much looking forward to.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So, brothers and sisters, and to our family on Facebook and to our family here at the Black Reality Think Tank, we were promoting the idea tonight that we wanted to sort of talk about. A lot of our ideas and thoughts for the program comes from my discussions with a lot of you over the week, during the week. Sometimes we sit down and we talk about different things. People like Brother Lush and Brother Timothy and some of our brothers and sisters with the Milwaukee Council. We sit down and we just go over little ideas. Sister Benicia, we talk about different things. And that's how a lot of times the ideas are sparked to discuss and some of the things that we choose to look at here on the Black Reality Think Tank. And so tonight we have been, as you know, our world has been in a crisis situation for a while. We have had this COVID that we have been enduring for some time, and it has been a very troubling situation. There are so many fallouts from the COVID-19, unemployment, all kinds of different things that are happening in terms of, education. Our children are having to go to school. So, I mean, I can go on and on, and I mean, you know what they are. We've all been victim to them. So I don't need to sit and to rehash them all over again. But one of the things that has really hit us bad, and it appears to be a result possibly of the COVID-19, is the crime and the insensitivity that people have against each other. And we've witnessed that in the George Floyd situation story. The other cases, a lot of them have happened in the city of Milwaukee, police shootings and mass killings and so forth and so on. So I thought I wanted to talk tonight a little bit about that whole idea, helping us to understand, and not so much just as a gossip, but as a way to solutions to work in our community, how to tell our children to prepare and to get them ready to handle and work and deal in what's known sometimes as a very cruel world. So we wanted to talk about that tonight. And one of the keys to that is how do we understand and sort of be able to explain and to articulate our crisis and the things that we are going through. And one of the big things that I've been hearing a lot about, so for instance, when individuals talk about the police brutality and some of the things that are going on in our community that way, the first reply that will come about is, well, what about black-on-black crime? How about black folks killing each other? How about that? Let's deal with that. Well, yeah, we do, and I would say that. But I want to really take a look at how do we understand that? How do we understand an issue like black-on-black crime? Where did that come from? What about, as I indicated in Alpha Moore, what about white-on-white crime? Do whites commit crime against each other? Do Hispanics commit crime against each other? Do Asians commit crime against each other? So what is it about we keep hearing the black-on-black crime? And there's a history to that. And I won't get into it totally tonight, but that began on a political agenda. All the way back in the early years of the 70s, you used to hear that black-on-black crime. And it kind of said, for instance, that black people hurt and kill each other unknowingly or to the fact that it has become, in some cases, a real crisis kind of situations in families. So the idea that black people kill each other is something exceptional or something that can only be fixed by black people. And a lot of that is rooted in the white supremacy past. And so the specific notion of a black-on-black crime, it has gained momentum for a long, long time. It goes all the way back to some of the writings that they were done about Africa, because, you know, we talk about here on the Black Reality Think Tank how we have been some of the most studied people of any person in the world, and there have been tons of books written about the makeup of the African and what that's like. And that was a book that was written back in the 1800s called The Race Traits and Tendencies of the American Negro. And one of the things it promoted is the basic idea that black people have a special crime problem. And that idea has permeated. It becomes a part of political agendas. It becomes a part of speeches. Presidents have been elected by using that whole idea, and it's been reworded and twisted. Newspapers play heavily on anything that happens in the black community, always reporting about crime, this, crime, that. And it got so bad back in the early 20s and 30s that, for instance, a lot of the black newspapers started and refused to write articles about black crime because it was no more than what whites were doing. So this notion of the black-on-black crime gained this momentum out of that book, because that book talked about it. It was written by a guy named Frederick Hoffman. And he didn't call it black-on-black, but it's really what it spelled. And so it became a part of sociology studies, and it became a part of criminology studies and things like that. And so it has been used consistently since that time to place the black community in a particular space and in a particular spot. And when you look at the stats don't necessarily speak to that if they're read properly. So tonight I wanted to ask our dear brother to come on, and he has done a tremendous amount of work in his research. Dr. Muhammad has done books on this black-on-black situation in terms of black males and what has been done with black males and the labeling of black males, calling us thugs and calling our women by names. He's done a tremendous amount of work on some of the ideology behind a lot of that. And so I wanted him to come tonight, and let's talk about that a little bit with you, our audience. Let's talk about this whole black-on-black crime cliche and how it's been used and what some of the neoconservatives did when they talked about war on drugs and things like that. Because when they said stuff like that, you know who they were talking about. And we always know when they talk about that. You know who they're talking about. And so tonight, let's take a look at that. So I want to go to Dr. Wesley and Muhammad and ask him to share some of his thoughts and his research. So I'm going to start off, Dr. Muhammad, by asking you about the research that you have been doing a lot of in terms of black males and some of the issues. What were you doing? What was the motivation for your wanting to look at life in that way? What was it that drove you to do that type of research and study?
Well, thank you, Dr. Rogers. You said brain full. You gave us great things to think about in your opening remarks. You know, my first piece written, my first excursion, if you will, into this area of the assault on black males began when I was a junior in high school. I wrote a book report on the genocide of black people and the assault on black males. I had encountered, of course, Dr. Jawanza Kinjufu's Countering the Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys. Mm-hmm. So as a junior in high school was when I encountered the concept and pursued it academically. And then when I heard the Honorable Brother Minister Farrakhan, as a senior in high school, and this is 1988, 89, and the Honorable Brother Minister Farrakhan unpacked the various angles of this conspiracy of against black people and against young black men in particular. He went so far in depth in revealing this conspiracy, and I must just ask our listening audience to never forget. I enjoy the movie The Messenger about the expose on Gary Webb, the great Gary Webb's expose in the San Jose Mercury, expose of the CIA spawning the LA crack epidemic. Gary Webb deserved that movie. He deserves his credit. But years before Gary Webb exposed the CIA spawning of the crack Holocaust in black America, it was the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan who said crack cocaine was a CIA conspiracy against black America. Now, Gary Webb, as much as he revealed, Gary Webb refused to take the final step. Gary Webb actually said no, that the conspiracy wasn't an anti-black conspiracy. He refused to acknowledge that fact, but what we have documented in our book, Understanding the Assault on the Black Man, Black Manhood, and Black Masculinity, Daniel Blandone, who Gary Webb exposed as the center agent, he's the one that provided Freeway Ricky Ross with his cocaine. Daniel Blandone said explicitly that his cocaine, he only made available to black people. He said, because black people, nobody cares what happens to them. So Daniel Blandone, the FBI, DEA agent, who's at the root of the crack cocaine Holocaust, he said specifically that he targeted black people with his cocaine. The Honorable Miss Louis Farrakhan, years before Gary Webb, was revealing these aspects of the conspiracy. So that's my context. Mm-hmm. My books, Understanding the Assault, Volume 1 and Volume 2, they only provide documentation mm-hmm. for revelation of this genocidal conspiracy that I heard from the Honorable Brother Minister Farrakhan. That's the context of my research.
That's powerful. That's powerful. All right, let me ask them. Now, we always like to look at cause and effect. And
yes, sir.
I'm a historian, and I always like to look at the roots of stuff. You know, where does yes, this sir. Come from? What is it that the black man poses as a threat that would make another human being go out and create a chemical and a drug that would not only destroy him, but his whole family for generations to come? Why would someone do that? What is it that I could possibly do to you that makes it necessary for you to want to do that for me? Do you have an idea of what you might think?
Oh, yes, I think I do. Right.
Please tell me.
It's very important. Your question is spot on. Most black people have a prop. They cringe when they hear us talk about this wicked stuff white people are doing to black people.
Right. Right.
And they cringe because they just can't conceive of another human being doing that to a fellow human being.
Right.
The problem is, Dr. Rogers, is we don't have the right perspective on who they are, so we can't fathom their motivations. And because we misidentify their motivations, we can't properly appreciate their actions. This is what I mean. Mm-hmm. The only way to understand the history of black white encounters, not the last 60 years, not the last 400 years, but going back to the very first recorded encounters between black and white. Mm-hmm. On a group dynamic, you can really use the Aryan invasion of black India, second millennium BC, and go all the way up from there to here. The history of the black-white encounter, the only way to understand it is to understand this fact. For white people, the black man is not a fellow human being, mm-hmm. not even a slave and a tool. To white people, the black man is a mortal enemy. Mm. These two terms are very important for black people to marinate on in our head. Mortal enemy. An enemy that is determined to bring about your and my death. Mm-hmm. This occurred before America was a thought in anybody's mind. When white folks went up into India, when white folks went up into my city, their blood lust for black, for all things black. In fact, their first religious text, Dr. Rogers, mm-hmm. the Rig Veda of the Indo-Aryans, their first religious text, holy text, their religion revolved around their celebration of the slaughter of black people. They mythologized it as killing the black gods of India and joyfully slaying the black skin. So white folks' first organized religion is organized around their murderous assault on the indigenous black population of India. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand that that's what we're dealing with. The black and white dynamic is a dynamic at the root of it is two mortal enemies. who are trying to work this thing out. Now, well, I would end there. The other point I would say a little later.
Okay. All right. So, okay. So let's. This is powerful for what you just said. Very powerful. Okay. So because of the spirituality concept of God, spirituality, Christianity, whatever, religion, so forth, it energizes, obviously, the human being.
Yes.
And it energizes them in a way that whatever they take on as a mission is being done in the spirit of the God that they know or believe in or have begun to worship. Am I correct with that statement? Say that part.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir, I would say so.
Right, okay. All right, so that means when someone who feels that encounters that opposite group, that group that's different, and they encounter that, they don't see, as you said, another human being. They see an enemy. They see something less than what they are as a person, correct?
Well, no, that I would not say.
Okay.
And I think it's a very important point. White supremacy and black inferiority, I wanted to make this point stimulated by your great opening remarks.
Right.
I think I say it now. The whole thing of black on black crime.
Right.
I want to put out there that, in my opinion, the concept of black on black crime is analogous to, it's the same type of animal as is the concept of white supremacy, by which I mean this.
Okay.
White supremacy takes two forms. White supremacy, the myth, and white supremacy, the reality.
Okay.
White supremacy, the myth, versus white supremacy, the reality.
Okay.
There is, what is the myth is the claim made by white people that white people as white people are inherently superior to all non-white people.
Mm-hmm.
That is a myth. White supremacy, the reality, is the fact of white hegemony on this planet. It is a fact that while white people constitute only one out of 11 people on the planet, white people have rulership over practically the entire planet. White supremacy, as white hegemony, the worldwide rule of this tiny minority of white people over the vast numbers of non-white people, that is a reality.
Mm-hmm.
So while we rightly condemn and give the lie to the myth of white supremacy, white hegemony, right, while it is justified by the myth of white supremacy, right, the argument is white folks rule the world because white folks are inherently superior to the world. That is a lie.
Right.
White hegemony is the result of a particular set of circumstances. Now, I say that black on black crime is a similar type of animal.
Mm-hmm.
By which I mean black on black crime takes two forms too. To your point, there is, just like there's white supremacy, the myth, there is black on black crime, the propaganda item.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
There is no question that black on black crime has been propagandized. It has been a very useful tool to the government, right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, Senator Hillary Clinton's super predator myth. That wasn't just thrown out there. That had a very specific strategic point, and they achieved that point. And the reason the super predator myth could be so successful is because it was couched in the propaganda piece of black on black crime. Mm-hmm. The flip side, so that black on black crime as the myth, like white supremacy as the myth, but there is a black on black crime phenomena that is as real as white hegemony.
Right.
It's real. It's just, and there is a history. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
I said it's just something? How it's been used. That's the difference.
Right. Correct? Uh-huh. But that is true. I live in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I've been here going on 10 years now. And I have become familiar with Southside Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I have become familiar with Northside Chicago. And of all of my years, Dr. Rogers, I have never experienced the level of segregation that exists in this city. The two worlds, South Chicago and North Chicago, are totally two different planets. Black on black murder is not just a rhetorical trope here in Chicago. One thing about this city, rarely does reality outstrip the reputation. You know, Chicago always had a rep of being violent and crazy. And I knew that rep before getting here. But I got to tell you, national news doesn't do justice to what's going on here in Chicago. So no one can tell me that black on black violence as a very distinct phenomenon is a myth. It is not. Now, what is a myth is that this very real phenomenon of excessive, because the issue is a matter of degree, mm-hmm. right? Everybody fight each other. But it is a fact that the level of black-on-black murder has increased specifically since the 80s, and we can give a specific date, a specific origin, a specific context of the emergence of this phenomenon of black-on-black violence as a real, as a reality. Now, the excessiveness, the myth says that black people are inherently violent. The reality is black people have been made excessively violent towards each other scientifically. That's what my two books document. Black people have been scientifically made excessively violent. That's not just rhetoric. We, here in Chicago, the studies to deplete this brain chemical, serotonin, depleted from young black males, is relevant here because serotonin is the biochemical key that turns on or turns off aggression, impulsivity, and violence. And these serotonin studies that came out of UCLA in the 80s, they were brought here to Chicago, and black boys were scientifically depleted, experimentally depleted of this brain chemical serotonin, producing generations of hyperviolent males, a situation that is fortified by the scientific creation of the hood or the ghetto. That environment feeds the scientific phenomenon of low serotonin, and this is the scientific spawn of excessive violence, which is why you don't see it in Evanston, Illinois, on the north side of Chicago, but you see it excessively south and west Chicago. So it is a reality that we should not dismiss, but we don't fall victim to the myth and the propaganda of it. Black, excessive black on black violence is a reality, and it condemns our enemy. Our enemy is at the root. They have scientifically bred this excessive level of violence in our community.
Mm, that's frightening. That's real frightening. And because then that raises the question, then how do you stop it? How do you cure it? How do you do that?
If, for example, there's so many answers to that question.
Okay.
And that is the right question. It was stated by one of the scientists involved in this program. The control, he said that coercive persuasion is what he called it. If I control an environment, if I have absolute control of a population's environment, I don't need to have hands on the body of that population. I can get that population to do whatever I want it to do just by having absolute control of the environment. That's why the ghetto is so important. That's why in 2021, America is more segregated than it was in 1964. Segregation of this country resists eliminating segregation because segregation serves so many purposes for this country. Social purposes, cultural purposes, but also scientific purposes. Segregation is your community and somebody else's. You are relegated to a community that's controlled by somebody else. That's the problem.
Yes, that's correct.
We have to, and so the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, we need to take total control of our communities, make our communities a safe and decent place to live. So the first step of what do? We have to break that absolute control that our enemies depend on, the absolute control of our communities, allowing them to behaviorally control everybody in our communities, including you and me, maybe at more subtle levels. But if we live in the black community, we are impacted by the scientific control and manipulations that go on here. So the first answer to your question, I would say, Dr. Rogers, what do we do? First thing, we have to get control, take control of our community.
Okay. Well, first of all, this is extremely powerful because you've taken us through a timeline of things here that very clearly speaks to some of what we see. And like I said, in a lot of cases, we can't explain it. So we then do other things, which makes it difficult to create an agenda that would be designed to do real change.
And so yes, sir.
Therefore, we've done some of that superfluous stuff that you've seen, and it's
yes, sir.
Not getting us anywhere because we don't know how to look at the real deal. And so,
yes, sir.
Why what you're saying tonight is so, so, so extremely important.
Praise belongs to Allah.
I think I look back and I look at history, I look at so many of the tactics that we have tried to use to grapple with this problem. And things like talking about integration and integrating
right.
into a house and boycotting and picking and singing songs and lighting candles
right.
and all of those. While they may make you feel a certain way, it does not remedy the problem. And so that's
not at all
what we wanted to look at tonight and talk about. Because and so the first thing to do with that is remedying the problem, you know, understanding what the problem is. And do
that is correct.
If you'd like for me to, I can open the line and take a couple of questions, and then we can close back and go.
Yes,
back
sir. Like. Yes, sir. I'll be happy to take
okay,
some questions.
I had promised my brother from Philadelphia, I think he's at Mosque number 9, that I would give him an opportunity to come on. Brother Timothy, am I correct? Is that your mosque?
Yes, sir. Temple number 12.
Okay.
Top of the clock.
Okay, great. So go right ahead. What do you have? A question for Dr. Westenheim?
Some questions, sir, and I'm not going to be long and have some statements. He came to Temple number 12 before the pandemic. I purchased one of his books, and his subjects, many subjects he talked about, was on the Navy beam. And I said to myself, he talked about the Navy beam so much. If I would have had a chance to take him to Germantown and Windham to Sister Muhammad's kitchen, he wouldn't have wanted to go back to Chicago. And I said,
oh,
and
no.
I said,
every time I go to Sister Muhammad's kitchen, I don't want to go back to Chicago.
Oh, you've been there?
Oh, absolutely. I don't come to Philly and leave without stopping at Sister Muhammad's kitchen.
Oh, my
That's
God. Listen to me. And the way you broke that Navy bean down, man, you talked about the carbohydrates, the fat, and the starch. I said, this is mean, man. Well, let me finish it. I had it in the yellow place. That's probably no longer around. Had some cousins that were from Mosque 25 in Newark. And my cousin right now today, Sutan, makes a mean bean pie.
And he gives it,
that's right. That's right. And he gives it out. And I thought about you. And I'm going to say two other things. I'm going to let the other people come in, a listening audience and our panel. I'm going to say this to you, brother, that I had a friend of mine, and he had a gymnasium today. It was at Claire Muhammad. Now, Claire Muhammad was the old University of Islam.
Yes, sir.
And now, of course, it went from Wallace to doing what they want to do. I went to his gymnasium, right? And the brothers would talk about what happened in 73 and what happened in 72 and what we had in Philly, what they had in the nation, the bank, the land, the jet. And I said to myself, they act like they're somewhere else in time. And that was fine with me. But when it was time for me to go, I said, we could pray together. We could pray together, brothers, but we can't walk together with this Orthodox Islam.
Right.
But I have one more thing I want to say. The other thing I want to say is, brother, is that understanding the concept of the original man in God, and I think I read a piece on your understanding of God. Now, see, in the nation, Clarence 13, they said to look at himself in the mirror to come to that reality. It's hard to hold on to something like that, telling people you God. However, God told people he was God all by himself. The message said right. The black man is God. How you hold on to that and be who right. you are as a person is a very hard thing to do. And now we're talking about the genocide of the black man, and I thought about the Davidian people in the Indus Valley and
right.
the Aryan invasion. And of course,
right.
the colonization of Africa. I'm not going to be too long, brother, because we could talk about many subjects. But since we talk about the black man being God and the black woman is a goddess, I'm going to put
right.
it on that one and let it roll. And I'm going to let other people come in, brother.
Okay. Very thank quick. You so much, Brother Timothy.
Thank you for those awesome comments.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Indeed.
Sister, Brother Herbie White, how are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and good evening to your guests.
Good evening to you.
Good evening.
On the question that you asked earlier about how could people do something like they do, Elijah Muhammad explained that the white man is the devil.
That is correct.
Plain okay. and simple. The white man is the devil.
Plain and simple.
If you understand that and you understand him, then you understand our relationship.
So the question gets answered right there. Okay, no further.
That is right.
So, so when you see...
That's a simple, truthful answer.
Yeah. So when you see what in the black community, what we call black-on-black violence, what you see in the black community is the European removing the culture and everything that makes a person a human being. Mm-hmm. Their spirituality, their customs, sir. Everything. You cannot practice those things. There's no way forward for a black man in a black community to be a man.
Right.
If you look at what happened in New York in the 90s and 90s and 2000s with under Bloomberg with stop and frisk.
Yes.
Right.
This is where the police could just walk up to you and search you anytime they want. They're telling you, you are not a man as long as I'm around because I can do this and there's nothing you can do about it. So they humiliated you every day.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have to swallow this type of humiliation, this type of abuse, and it builds up the anger and the hatred and the frustration and the inability for you to express yourself in any meaningful way, the only thing left for you to do is turn to anger and violence.
Right.
Exactly.
And you take it out on the people closest to you.
Yeah.
That is right.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I just like to make a little comparison that I like to use. That if you have a classroom full of children and every day you have a recess, and at recess you give the children 3 cookies and a glass of milk, and you give that to all the children except for one. You don't give Johnny no cookies and milk. Every day the other children get it and he don't.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon Johnny's going to hurt somebody.
Right. Right.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Right.
All right. Thank you so much, Brother White. I appreciate it. Definitely right on point.
White man is the devil.
Yeah. Dr. That's Wesley, it. Anything you want to add on to that piece my brother said?
No. Excellent.
Okay.
The white man is the devil.
Right. Exactly.
But I would add this. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad's further statement, which again answers your question of how such a man can do that. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said the white man is the devil, and he said, brother, you cannot fathom the depths of Satan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's
so
true.
This is why we look at what he does and we scratch our head and we just can't believe that another human could do that, and we are right.
Exactly.
A human will not. But Satan, whose depths cannot be fathomed, does.
You know, I really enjoyed, and I like what the brother Raul Peck, who did the piece on James Baldwin back here ago, I'm Not Your Negro, he's done one now called Murdering the Brute, Exterminating All the Brutes. And when he documents from records, particularly what happened in Belgium, I mean, you see what the Belgians did. And even in parts of the Congo, in Africa, and the brutalization and the level of that is just almost is unbelievable, as you said. And you can't even begin to fathom. I don't have that much evil for nothing in the world that I would do just with some of those things that he showed. He did a very good job, and I think that's waking some of our people up now to ask that question: who are we dealing with? You know. And you're forced to do that. I mean,
and I think, if I could add, I think what we are saying now specifically speaks to the question, one of the questions raised earlier in terms of black-on-black crime. Well, is there not white-on-white crime? I think we should resist making that analogy because the premise of that analogy is that black people and white people are of the same nature.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you.
We watch all of these European movies, right? Game of Thrones and Caesar, and we see white people just murderous towards each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Their whole history, the two world wars, those were white nations. Yes, white people are murderous towards each other. Now, if they are the standard of humanity, of course we will look at that and say, well, it's natural for humans to be so murderous towards each other. So when we see black people being excessively murderous towards each other, hey, it's all the same. It's just human. That's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
White people have been made so murderous, but that is not our natural way. Black people and white people are not the same. Our nature, our temperament isn't the same. And the history of Europe versus the history of Africa proves that while there was always conflict, no doubt. There was political wars, no doubt. But you don't have the level of murder and brutality among ourselves as you find among white people.
Yes.
So that cannot be the standard by which we judge black people in the city. We are not violent towards each other in the city for the same reason white people are violent towards each other in Europe.
Very good point. That's exactly right. Exactly right. And when we do look at these type killings that we see, you know, plastic bags, duct taking people with that, and shooting wow. everybody in the head across the family, you're looking at a different level kind of thing.
Because they enjoy that.
Yeah.
That's a blood lust that they're feeding. They have perfected the art of murder. Murder is an art for the natural murder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have books. You, for example, when you study the Inquisition, and there's a good book, but a very grotesque book entitled Inquisition,
right.
A bilingual guide to the exhibition of torture instruments. And it's just a pictographic book showing the very various science and artistic ways of torture and murder that mm-hmm. were invented. You, only someone with a particular mind and spirit would create these scientific and artistic ways of killing and torturing people.
Yes. And do it by design, as you said. I mean,
by design.
Like you would build a house or
absolutely
your car. You do that way.
And then, with the same level of glee and joyfulness.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that puzzles when we do look at that and the level of that. And again, for our audience, this is extremely critical because we one of the things we always want to do is look at ways that we can create agendas and write things for change and implement change in our community.
Right.
But again, you have to understand what you're dealing with, you know, as you talk about doing that. I remember.
And that's the problem. Mm-hmm. That's why all of our efforts to redress our black people's social, political, economic problems here in America, all of our agendas have been empty. All of our efforts have been futile. I'm sorry, but they have. The reason is because we don't understand who we're dealing with.
That's
we keep
right.
trying to appeal to a level of consciousness and rationality that is not there. As wise and learned and smart as white people are, I'm not denying that, but their bloodlust and mortal hatred for black people renders them irrational in dealing with us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we, all of our agendas, right? So we still think there were two things that came out of the George Floyd protests around this nation.
Okay.
Two documented outcomes.
One,
right,
the increase in COVID cases among black populations, and two, a record windfall, economic windfall for the Democratic Party and voter registration of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
The George Floyd's death was used as an opportunity to register black people to vote on the assumption that this is the answer to the problem of police murk. We think that by changing president, we are going to do away with police murder, but this increased level of police murder occurred under President Barack Obama.
That's right.
It was under the black president that we see this extreme spike in police aggressiveness, because it was the white backlash.
Mm-hmm.
So our agenda, our solutions to the problem are always so little effective or non-effective, because we are going about it with the wrong understanding of who we're negotiating with.
Yes. Yes. Let me... Brother Griffin, you're posting some profound thoughts. Why don't you share a little bit of that with our audience and Dr. Muhammad, maybe. I know you had your phone muted, but maybe you do that with us. Share some of those profound thoughts that you are putting up on the message board, because everybody can't see that message board. So why don't you do that for us? Brother Griffin? Brother Otis Griffin, you were posting... I said some profound messages on the message board. So your phone might be muted. I have it unmuted here.
Yes, brother Muhammad.
Brother Griffin.
No, this is Brother Timothy. Let Brother Griffin talk. I come behind him.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, sir, Brother Timothy.
Brother Griffin, are you there?
Can you hear me now, sir?
No, your phone has got a backlash to it.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, but it's got a reverb. Go, talk just a little bit louder. Talk just a little bit.
Can you hear me now?
Okay, go right ahead. I hear you now.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm in my shop, and I have this thing rigged up so funny. But you can read the comments I make, because I'm sure he'll understand it, and I appreciate his knowledge and the way he presents the information without hesitation. But I want to say this. I said to you, and the one comment I will share while I'm live is, he talked about the white man, but I said to you, he commits those kind of crimes and with no remorse whatsoever. In fact, right. The thing that distinguishes him from, quote, actual God-fearing people is he finds satiation and gratification in it. There is
that
no
is
remorse.
Exactly. Well said.
Exactly right.
Keep doing that work,
well,
man. I'm 67.
You too, sir. 67. May Allah continue to bless that beautiful black mind of yours.
Yeah, that's right on target. Thank you, Dr. Brother Griffin. I wanted you to post that, because I know you, like I said, it was some profound things, and everybody can't seize that.
Absolutely.
You know, I think about that Hollywood version of the movie Hannah Lectable.
Silence of the Lamb.
Yeah, Silence of the Lamb. And when he would kill, after he finished the kill and the eating of the blood, he would play classical music.
Yes, sir.
And go.
Yes, sir.
And the question,
sir,
I even had back
excellent
then.
Excellent illustration.
What kind of mind is that?
Excellent illustration.
What kind of mind can do that? You know,
a mind that you cannot fathom. Yeah. As the Masana Bulaj Muhammad said.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay, Brother Lush, how you doing tonight, Brother Lush?
Fine. Thank you for taking my calling. And assalamu alaikum, Brother Muhammad.
Wa alaikum salam, Brother Lush.
I'd like to turn the mirror onto ourselves as a black population. You know, what you were speaking earlier, and other callers were calling calling in. What came to my mind was about John Calhoun. John Calhoun was that psychologist who talked about the rat study, et cetera, and talked about overpopulation and the kind of behavior that results in that. The question that I have for you is, for us as Black people, is there, does it make sense for us to talk about how we should control our population with regards to, you know, not having as many children or being stuffed in a particular area at all? Should we be able to entertain that kind of conversation, which, according to Calhoun, would result in all kinds and types of unnecessary behavior? Would we be in line and talking about overpopulation amongst ourselves?
Well, I would say yes, but I would say our discussion would be about overpopulation of white people on the planet. Dear brother, from my research, the white talking point of overpopulation has always been a propaganda piece to justify taking murdering enough of the third world to create space for Western nations to come in and exploit the resources of the third world. Overpopulation is a trope of white supremacists seeking to control the land and resources of the third world, and in order to do so, they have to limit and control the demography or the population of the third world. It's just like eugenics. One mistake that we make is believing that eugenics is white folks' plan for black folks. Now, eugenics is white folks' plan for white folks. Dysgenics is white folks' plan for black folks. Eugenics is the ideal of weeding out lower human traits with the aim of producing a superior human being. Dysgenics is the opposite. Dysgenics is a process of grafting in lower human traits with the aim of deliberately creating a lowly human being. Mm-hmm. And the circumstances that prevail in the so-called ghetto or the hood, the segregated communities of America in particular, those conditions that prevail therefrom, the nature of the water that is pumped into our community, the very air that we breathe in black zip codes is distinctly different from the air breathed in white zip codes. The particulate matter content has been studied. Black zip codes have a higher concentration of particulate matter than white zip codes do. And all of this is conducive to grafting in the human population lower human traits, producing a subhuman type. That's the design, the deliberation. So what the conversations we should be having among black people is not limiting the number of black people that come into this world, but creating the conditions that produce a superior human being. Black people should be not depopulators in our thinking, but black people absolutely should be eugenicists. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say that again. Eugenics gets too bad a rap among white people, among black people, because we misunderstand it. Black people absolutely should be eugenicists, meaning we should be about
creating a superior human being. We should be about making sure that my progeny is a better human being by all metrics that I am.
Mm-hmm.
So black folks should never have a Kronos problem. The Kronos problem is a white, that's white people's thing. You know, Kronos is the Greek god who ate his own sons, and white fathers historically battled white sons.
Mm-hmm.
Black people cannot afford to have no Kronos issues. Black fathers should never see black sons as rivals. Black mothers should never see black daughters as rivals. Black mothers and black, or black males and black females, before we even become mothers and fathers, we should be eugenicists.
Right.
That means we should create the environment and the circumstances that facilitate the production of superior human beings. So no, Brother Lush, I don't believe that black people should be entertaining the conversation of limiting black population. I believe our conversation should be about improving black population, mm-hmm, eugenically.
Mm-hmm. And so, Dr. Wesley, when in doing that, we're gonna have to do some real root work to do that. We're gonna have to go back to social values, and how
exactly
we bring families together,
exactly,
and do some of those kinds of
that's
things.
The
so
point,
right?
That's
so
exactly the point. So, and if I could say,
sure, go right ahead.
That note, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that there were three things the white man declared he would never teach black people. So with all of the black institutions that the Freedmen's Bureau set up, and I'm a product of HBCU, Morehouse College, and I'm very proud of that.
Yes, indeed.
But with all of the black education gifted to us by our mortal enemy, there were three things that we never learned in school because they declared they would never teach black people. One, the science of business.
Right.
Two, the science of warfare. And three, the science of mating.
Mm-hmm.
The science of mating. See, that's eugenics.
Yes.
The science of selectively breeding superior human beings. There's a science to that. The black folks need to be about eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
But
can
white
I think,
folks plan for us with dysgenics. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I want to come in, but brother, finish your statement, you and Dr. Rogers, Brother Muhammad. I want to come in behind that. Take your time.
Okay.
No, I was finishing it that black white folks' plan for themselves was eugenics, and their plan for black people was dysgenics. I'm saying that black folks' plan for ourselves should be a righteous eugenics.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Okay, Brother Timothy, go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to say this, that I agree with all that, and studying different cultures, that the Indians from the Indus Valley understood the importance of gene pool.
Yes,
now,
sir.
Right, the Aryan invasion brought in the caste system. That's different.
But, yes, sir.
Right, that's a different thing going on. And you know what?
Absolutely.
Even in the Nile Valley, they always had a royal family. Wait a minute,
yes, sir.
Now. Not what they call in England. Now, I ain't talking about that. I'm talking about, and they were amongst each other sociably, economically, and I won't even say politically because it always was politics, but you was almost given a partner for the specifics of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the science of mating.
That's right.
The science of mating. And like you said, war. And guess what? Like you always talk about the Navy being diet.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely. Uh-huh.
Right.
And you said war, diet. What's the
business?
Business.
Exactly. And you know what? We did that in the first. We did
That's
that
right.
in the first. And the messenger, he he coached and said, I mean, you had to find the right partner now. He wanted to build a nation, not a plantation.
And usually the community does that. The community helps him find the right partner.
That's right. And in that, you know, don't nobody make a man like Muhammad, we said. And you look at the men that came out of there. Look at the women that came out of there.
Right. That is right.
Muhammad Ali, Louis Farrakhan. It goes on.
Malcolm X. Wallace Muhammad.
Sonia Sanchez. I can go on and on. Taneta Muhammad. Right. I can just go. And, you know, we got to get, like I said, when I left that gymnasium, I said, you know, I could pray with y'all, but we can't walk together. Because you went with being hooked by Orthodox Islam by Wallace.
Right.
And I said to myself, Wallace had an interesting thing in his head. But guess what? Whatever he had in his head, he put in their head. And they guess what? The message of anybody slow and multiplying will be left behind.
Right.
And they bought into the Orthodox Islam, and that's where they're at. And the brothers that are moving along and the sisters are moving along in the nation, we're moving along with the best we got.
Right.
Yes,
the best we can do.
Let's go.
Louis Farrakhan as a reminder for raising it, the messenger's name back up and putting it together.
That's right. And if I may say this, you know, the Honorable Brother Minister Farrakhan helps us to understand the divine role that Imam Wahiduddin Muhammad played. We don't follow the Imam, but may Allah be pleased with him. The Honorable Brother Louis Farrakhan loves the Imam.
Mm-hmm.
He had a work to do. The work, what was the work? The Honorable Elijah Muhammad saw his son one day and said this: I would not want his job, meaning Wallace's job. Wallace had a job, just as God has a left hand and a right hand. Wallace, in his role of destroying the Nation of Islam, was acting as the left hand of God himself.
Yes.
So we don't follow the Imam in the Orthodox way, but we can find common ground to be brothers with them, but we do not follow them. But nor do we hate them.
Right. I can understand that very clearly. I also want to remind, I don't know if that tape is still around. That was a series that I remember Minister Farrakhan spoke on, the making of a God.
Yes, sir. How to give birth to a God.
Yeah, right, exactly. How to give birth to a God.
Very important.
That was one of the most powerful
pieces. That's divine eugenics.
That's powerful. Powerful piece.
That's divine. He lays out the program for divine eugenics.
And
eugenics isn't the creation of the evil white man.
Right.
They had their evil eugenics, but how to get birth to a God.
How to get birth to.
By the Honorable Brother Minister Farrakhan,
yeah,
lays
a
out
piece.
The program of divine eugenics.
It sure was. I even made my son come and listen to that with me. And he listened to that tape, and we talked about it after it was over. And that is a classroom piece. But exactly right. Let me go to my sister. Sister Ayan, how are you tonight?
Oh, I am great because I'm loving this program.
Okay, beautiful.
Yes, how are you?
Praise the Lord to Allah. Iyan.
Sister Ayan, Boniswa Ayan. I spoke a couple of months or so ago.
Yeah, matter of fact, with the first program that we did with you, Brother Muhammad, was Ms. Ayan set that up for us. She made the contact.
Wonderful. Thank you, dear sister.
Well, thank
it's
you.
Good to speak to you again.
Yes, yes, I say. Listen, I want to make a. So it's just wonderful to hear you teaching, brother. You just, we need you. We need you.
Praise belongs to Allah.
Yes, yes,
thank
yes.
Thank you so much. Humble me.
Absolutely. I want to make a quick comment and then throw out a question.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, the trauma. We always have to make mention of the trauma that we've gone through by the hands of these predators.
Yes, ma'am.
And how Absolutely. It's impacted us, how it's affected us. Because trauma doesn't allow people to see the obvious.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're always talking about how we just can't believe that people would act like that.
Yes, ma'am.
First of all, I don't think they're people. They're predators.
That is excellent.
So predators do what they do.
That is
right.
They
go after their prey, and they continue until they get their prey.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Excellent.
So, as I listen to our people who are not conscious, who are in denial, I'll say denial mm-hmm. about who this predator really is. If we, I feel like I want to push our people, and we should push our people a little harder to listen and to see and to think,
mm-hmm.
because we, when you look at the book, I always talk about this book, Without Sanctuary.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
And you see
mm-hmm.
all the torture they put our brothers, our people through. Thousands
yes,
of lynchings. Look at their
mm-hmm.
cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
Violent.
Mm-hmm.
I remember as a child seeing, you know, these cartoon characters hitting each other in the head with hammers and blowing each other up.
Right.
Who what kind of mind gives that to children as for entertainment?
Absolutely.
And then the last example, because there are so many, their own horror movies, which I will not watch, but I used to. Their own horror movies, guess who they go after?
Yeah, they're brutal.
What is it, Jason and all those that stab each other?
That's right.
They go after their own teenagers.
That is right.
So something is wrong with those people. They are predators.
Bono's complex. That's right.
Yes, that bloodlust that somebody mentioned.
That's
you know,
right.
They have to have that blood and that violence. So my firm belief is that we must separate. We must, because there's no
Bingo.
Way to survive
with
these monsters.
That's
we can't
right.
do it. Now, you probably talked to so many people, brother. You may not remember this conversation, but I want to remind you because this is my question. I called you and we talked briefly about some of the changes that I've seen. I've been on this earth for 60-something years, and I remember when I was growing up, black men had hair.
Yes, ma'am.
Black men were in their 50s and their 60s. They had hair on their head.
I remember that conversation. Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
Remember? Okay.
I remember that conversation with you.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely.
And I mean, even my father, all of his peers, they got older. They had hair on their heads. Now I'm looking at our brothers in their 30s and their 40s, and they're losing all of their hair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And who has hair now? White
That's
men.
Right. That's right.
Looking at them with full heads of hair.
That's right.
And
That's
so I'm
right.
saying, to your point earlier, chemical warfare, they're doing
That's
much
right.
more than we understand that they're
That's
doing
right.
to us. So I want to know if you looked into that further, because that's serious. We have no idea what they're doing to us.
It absolutely is serious, and it is an indication of the chemical assault
yes.
on yes. black men. You know, the hairiness of men in general versus women is a secondary sexual characteristic, right? As the curviness of women versus the rectangular shape, more or less, of men. And one of the results of this chemical assault on black America, you see black men's physique, you know, with millennials and certainly with Gen Z, more men of the millennial generation and Gen Z look like Wiz Khalifa or Snoop Dogg versus a 50 Cent. Now, if you said you're about 60, 67, you may not be able to visualize that. Wiz Khalifa is very thin, right? There's little to no robustness
to his physique versus a 50 Cent was very robust. Most of the young men of the millennial and Gen Z generation is very fragile of physique.
Brother teacher, yes.
And that is a result of the chemical assault. The robustness of the male physique is a secondary sexual character, not the secondary sexual characteristic. But you don't find it among the younger generations now because of this chemical assault. So the diminishing, the early diminishing of the hairline, no doubt, is another effect of the chemical assault. The black America is under, and in particular, the black male.
I say, brother, because I see the complete difference between the men that I grew up with and the young men now, the feminization, all that.
Yes.
That
yes,
hair.
Man.
That, wait a minute. So,
the
yeah.
hair and the physique.
And you see it.
I'm sorry, repeat?
I said, with the hair and the physique, you see it.
Yes, it's obvious.
You see it today like we've never seen it before.
And it's scary.
It is.
Yes,
scary.
It is. Yes, it is. No doubt about it.
It is scary. It's disheartening.
Yeah.
It's disheartening.
We don't know what they're doing, so it's like we're sitting victims, and I don't like that. That's why I said we need to separate. Let's not subject ourselves to this
solution.
Anymore.
That is the only solution.
Only solution. Thank you, my brother.
Thank
All right.
you, my sister.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, sister. I appreciate that. And, you know, Dr. Wesley Muhammad, you know what I think about quite often, and I know you have done some reading on that. I have tried my best to understand some of that reading as well. Is the Nazi philosophy system? All of this is not. In other words, that process is not anything new. The Nazis
right.
had been working on trying to perfect that science since its early beginning.
That is right.
And a lot of it is rooted in their work in history. Am I correct?
That is correct. You know, Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, National Socialist Party, was anchored in the religious order of the Thor Society.
Right.
Who were very well aware of the origins of white people, and Adolf Hitler advanced he was a eugenicist, in fact.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Nazi eugenics is the child of American eugenics. Adolf Hitler looked to American eugenicists to get his inspiration for his eugenics program, and it must be said here, the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, you know, with due respect to the great W.E.B. Du Bois, but he and other Negro leaders launched a get rid of Garvey movement. They called him a traitor because the Honorable Marcus Garvey befriended and worked with the white eugenicists of America, the same white eugenicists that inspired Adolf Hitler's.
Yeah, I've heard
not
that.
Eugenics. Now, why would the Honorable Marcus Garvey cooperate with racist white eugenicists? Well, because he understood. Was he a traitor? No, he wasn't a traitor.
Right.
Marcus Garvey wanted purity of blood and the birth of superior black human beings, which had to, we needed separation. For that to happen, black people cannot produce eugenically superior black human beings as long as we live in the midst of white people.
Yes.
We have to separate to fully secure our genetic posterity as much as our social and economic posterity. And the Honorable Marcus Garvey was not offended by white folks wanting to create superior white folks through eugenics. He said he wanted to create superior black folks. Mm-hmm. Separation and healthy breeding. He was right for that.
Right.
And that's why we advocated today the science of mating. And so I'm not offended by Nazism. I'm not. Hitler hated the black people,
mm-hmm,
like he hated Jews. He wanted to create a superhuman white race.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the difference between white eugenics and black eugenics, it illustrates the difference between the two natures. White people are murderous by nature of black people. So even a rational and good idea, they weaponize against black people. I'm sorry, but Jesus said in the Bible, and it's very quotable, whatever we think of the Bible, this certainly should be quoted. He said, you are of your father, the devil.
Yeah.
He was a liar and a murderer from the beginning. This is very important. Lie and murder is in the nature of the people who have been a predator. Excellent, excellent, excellent description. They have been predatory to black people for 6,000 years.
Right.
So whatever they do, water is not bad, but they found a way to weaponize water against their mortar enemy, weaponize air against their mortal enemy, weaponize food against their mortal enemy. So Adolf Hitler and Nazism, this illustrates how, how America is the origin of such wickedness.
Yeah.
George Herbert Bush's father, Prescott Bush, was a major financial supporter of Nazism. But that shows the extreme, that shows the wicked use of a program, whereas we're talking about a very righteous use of the program. Separation and divine eugenics, the science of mating, or the engineering of an environment that facilitates the birth of superior quality human beings,
mm-hmm,
and my progeny and yours.
Right, exactly. Okay, now I've got to ask, because and we probably don't have enough time to get totally all the way into it.
And yeah, maybe, I have till 9 o'clock.
Okay, good. We're off. We go off at 9. And
okay, yes.
So I wanted to, but I do want to just pique this question in there just a little bit. And if it just takes too much to deal with the answering of it, we can move it to the next time we talk. Okay, but it's always been well known, particularly in the black nationalist community, in terms of studying and learning, that the original man was the black man.
Yes, sir.
And that was the, as anthropologists have tried to describe, that was the Adam and Eve of the world, were black men.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Now, so how then does a student who understands that, who learned that or is taught that, how do they then deal with understanding what happened? That why, if we are the same people, if the white man is the sons and daughters of the African man, how does that happen? Now, I know we talk about melanin and some of those things, but sometimes those things get crisscrossed and confused, where the young man has trouble grappling that.
Yes.
So how do you, you're probably talking to the teachers now. What do you tell a teacher who wants to use that? How do you deal with that?
And that is absolutely a conceptual problem,
right,
and I put that in quotes, that we have to deal with. If white people are outnumbered on this planet 11 to 1,
mm-hmm,
then we absolutely have to account for the fact that this tiny minority has had near absolute dominion over the human family,
mm-hmm,
for millennia now. No, we have to wrestle with that.
You got to reckon with that.
And if we don't properly handle that, then that sets up, what's the term I'm looking for? Cognitive dissonance.
Cognitive, right, exactly.
In the mind of black people, because all of this literature, we were gods, we were kings, but we cannot stop police officers from killing us for sport. We can't stop that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all of this great. That cognitive dissonance is real if we can account for the circumstance of white rule over black gods. I know that the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad gave the answer to this quandary, conceptual
right,
quandary that we find ourselves
mm-hmm
in. He said that God went to sleep, that the black man suffered a fall, allowing this minority, this new minority on the planet to rule. And so all of the scriptures speak of a fall that occurred on the earth among the original people 6,000 years ago.
Yeah.
The black man suffered a fall in Egypt. Ancient Kemet is a beautiful illustration of a fall that's applicable to the black nation as a whole. Egypt was strong. But when we study Egypt or ancient Kemet in its greatness, and study ancient Kemet in its fall,
mm-hmm,
at the end of Egypt's Kemet timeline, white folks were wearing the garb of the pharaoh. White folks had usurped not just the political authority, but the culture and the wisdom of ancient Egypt, and Egypt with all of its greatness failed. Those beautiful black minds could create structures in the desert that baffles the best minds of the world today.
Yes,
yet,
it does, yeah.
The culture that produced that is not here today. Only in history books. It failed.
Mm.
The black man and woman globally suffered the same fall, the same usurping by white people. We live that reality right now. The white minority has usurped black rule, because black people fail. Black people suffer things among ourselves,
mm-hmm,
that allow this minority to rule. So we need to study how and why black people fail, allowing this tiny minority to rule us, and then we need to reverse the process of that fall. We need to undo what was done.
Powerful.
And we need to do the opposite.
Powerful.
Some of the things that were done that resulted in our fall and the usurping by our enemy.
That's powerful. And that's the work. That's the work ahead. You're right. Yes. Okay, let me, Brother Kwasi, how are you doing tonight? Brother Kwasi?
Hey, Dr. Rogers.
Good.
Hey, hello.
Fine, how you doing?
All right.
Okay.
I love what's going on. This is awesome.
Great. Any questions or comments for Brother Muhammad?
No, I just, I was thinking about earlier when you talked about us misidentifying the motivation, you know, is deep. And so how, if you misidentify the motivation, how are you coming up with a solution?
That is right. Yes, sir.
And we keep going in that same spin all the time. So,
yes, sir.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Kwame. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brother, how many you want to try to look at that, or just we leave it there because we have said that before. We have looked at it previously to that.
I don't have much to add. I appreciate that reiteration. Yes.
Yeah.
And unless we properly understand what motivates white people vis-a-vis black people, then right. We could never counter their actions against us.
Right, exactly. So, Sister Dee Dee, how are you tonight? Sister Dee Dee?
Yes, hello?
Yes, hi. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. Loving the program. Assalamu alaikum to you, brother.
Waalaikum salam, dear sister.
Thank you. Peace and blessings out there, family. I am really just enjoying the program.
Okay.
And Sister John, I know she said a mouthful, and the brother has been awesome tonight.
Thank you.
Like she said.
Thank you.
And as Sister John said, we need to separate. And
we
this
do.
Is, we cannot continue to try and romanticize with this beast.
Yeah.
We just can't.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers.
That's
we
true.
Cannot continue to romanticize with this piece.
That's a good one.
Excellently.
I like that. That was well put. Thank you, Sister Dee Dee.
Absolutely.
I love it.
And you're welcome, both these brothers.
Right. I love it. I love it. Dr. Maxwell, how you doing tonight? I'm so happy that you were. I was glad I heard your voice yesterday, so it seems like you have gotten well and you're doing a lot better. Do you have a question or comment for Dr. Wesley Muhammad? Dr. Maxwell? Okay, so he might be away from his phone. I go back there. Let me go to 414-372. Any questions or comments, caller? 471-372. Any questions or comments? Okay. All right. Philadelphia, 484-423. Questions or comments? Caller? Oh, just a second. Okay. Okay. Caller, 484-2432. Philadelphia? All right. Okay. And 414-507. Call questions? Caller?
No, I'm really, this is LaRue. It's very enlightening. I think it's important for us to understand that there is a difference between us and the white man. And I think one thing that confuses us is the fact that we believe we're all the same under the skin. So I'm glad you brought that to the focus.
Great. That's great. That's great.
Thank you for letting me in. All right.
Brother, Dr. Wesley, that's my brother LaRue Ned. He wrote a book called Why We Shouldn't Call Our Ancestors Slaves. Very dynamic piece of literature. He's done a lot of work in there.
I certainly agree with the title.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you're done.
Thank you, Doc.
Okay.
Thank
yep, you're
you.
Done.
I'll call you tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay, we've got, ladies and gentlemen, I really appreciate it. We only got a few minutes left. I'm going to ask Dr. Wesley Muhammad if he'll close it out. We appreciate all of you. We sort of suspended some of our regular things that we might do tonight because I really wanted to hear from this brilliant brother. I've enjoyed him so much over the years. and even in his work and the things that he's done, and the reach out and the information and the knowledge that he brings to our people. We have to have that. We have got to do that for that next generation that is coming behind us. It is critical that we do that. And we've heard that tonight from him. Those of you who've had questions trying to understand the nature of this problem and how to resolve it among ourselves. You know, we have to do this for us. It's not necessarily trying to do it for any exterior group, but it's important that we do this. And we have to be logistical about doing it, and we have to be consistent. And we can't let this up. And that's one of the reasons that the Black Reality Think Tank exists and the programs that we try to produce here is to give a platform for us to come together and try to weave this web in a positive way for us. And so we're going to keep hitting at it. We're going to keep hitting at it. We're not going to stop. We have other programs on here. We just didn't get a chance tonight to go through all of those. So I'm going to forego that and let Dr. Muhammad give us some parting thoughts along his line and the work that he's been doing in the nation. I do want to ask in that closing remark, Dr. Muhammad, would you just a little bit, Brother Timothy, you kept talking about that the Navy bean and so forth. Just mention just a wee bit and give the title of that book once more in case someone wants to go read up on that themselves.
Yes, sir. The title of the book is How to Eat to Live by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Because when you ask Dr. Rogers, well, what's the solution? There is my first two answers would be, the first one I gave was, we need to take control of our communities so that if we control the environment, then we can start creating superior human beings. We do that by controlling our environment and controlling our diet. Diet is essential to the production, not just of health, but of a quality human being. And the diet that's imposed on us by our enemies and the food that Black people eat for the most part is food provided by our enemies, the food in Black zip codes. The food that's provided to us is food that's weaponized against. Likewise, it's food that's going to help heal us. The right food as the wrong food in large part created the biochemical problem that we have. The right foods will help correct the biochemical problems that we have. The navy bean is a profound counter-offensive. The navy bean is a counter-offensive against the chemical assault against us. So getting our diet right is a critical step in the, well, what do we do? It's a critical step in countering the conspiracy against Black people. And you find that in the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
Oh, yeah.
Two volumes set, How to Eat to Live.
Oh,
every
yeah.
Black home should have this in their kitchen.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Powerful. And I do. I have that. Definitely needs to be a part of any curriculum that deals with African
yes,
people. Yes, indeed. No doubt
yes,
about
sir.
That. And very powerful. And then I would add, you know, Dr. Weston Raman, message to the Black man, particularly.
Absolutely.
Those that are trying to still wage that war out here and still trying to do that fight. So in closing, what are some of the things coming up that you're involved in? I know you're busy. That's probably a very long list. But they didn't say what are some of the things that you're involved in right now that maybe let our audience know that you know we could listen.
Yes, sir. Well, we are
we, the Nation of Islam, are engaged in this fight for the life and the health of our people, exposing the COVID conspiracy against us, not just the virus, but the vaccine conspiracy and the economic aspects of the COVID conspiracy. So we are fighting to keep our people from subjecting ourselves to this military technology, this masquerading as a vaccine, this military program, this masquerading as a public health program. It is not. So that is our fight right now. Well, I'm also completing the project, Dr. Rogers, on Malcolm X.
Oh, great.
That's my latest project that I hope to have completed. I am departing radically. While I appreciate the offers made in understanding the assassination of Malcolm X, Zach Condo, Carl Evans, Manny Marble, and others have made significant contributions, but I have to say they all have missed the mark in terms of understanding what happened on that fateful day, February 21st, 1965, and why.
Okay.
And so my project, God willing, will bring some much-needed clarity to the murder of Malcolm X, the how, the why, and most importantly, the who.
All right.
And I'm saying that Zach Condo and,
well, I'm waiting.
Netflix has not adequately answered those questions for us.
Well, I am waiting. I am waiting, and I'll be more than happy to pass it on to others as well. Thank you so much,
Wonderful. Dr. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming. I really do.
I appreciate you, Dr. Rogers.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You. I thoroughly enjoyed our time together tonight.
Great.
You and your wonderful, wonderful listening audience.
Yes,
I love
it. Good. This is a wonderful family that we have. Actually, Dr. Wesley, this is a family of us. And
I feel it.
And it's great.
I feel it.
And I appreciate it.
Through.
Yes, it is. Thank you all. We'll be back next Tuesday, same time, 7 o'clock, Black Reality Think Tank. Have a wonderful week, people. Very safe. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.